What might life aboard those ships have been like? What, for example, did the men think of Cabrillo? What was their daily life aboard like? What kinds of hardships did they have to live through?
The hardships on the expedition were as great as they usually were with any expedition of this type. Food had a tendency to go bad in the holds, which were damp and wet, and the ships weren't anywhere near of the quality they were to later be. The commander on most of these vessels sooner or later had a problem of mutiny or almost mutiny because of living conditions and the general debilitation of the crew got it to the point generally where the crew didn't want to continue any longer. Francisco Ulloa, who was a friend of Cortez and one of his captains, along with Cabrillo, however, both seemed to have been men who would push their crews to the limit, but seemed to know when that limit was arrived at. It's hard to describe a Renaissance soldier as a humane man, but their leadership was of such quality that they knew how far they could push their men. All through the summary logs of the early voyages, we get the impression of concern for his men and yet a real motivation toward discovery and the advancement of the cause of those who sent him out. There's no question that he was a patriot in the best possible sense.
What class of man would have been on the crew of, let's say, Cabrillo's expedition?
Well, it's a popular, certainly popular with some historians to describe them mostly as the scum of the jails of Seville, and that most of the conquistadors were not from the best elements of society. But I have a tendency to feel that this is more a reflection of our or of some social views of our time rather than of reality. Certainly many of them were poor. Certainly many of them were entrepreneurs. Certainly many of them were out for the main chance. I don't find that even in the academic world too much at variance with what we have today. However, they were not those who would hold or would stay behind. As Richard the Lionheart said, thank God we were not born clerks, and I suspect most of them would have felt that that was a fairly reasonable statement. Some were outstanding. There is no question about that. They were courageous, intelligent. Certainly this would describe Cabrillo. And I suppose they had their share of those who, when pressed, wouldn't come up to scratch. But on the whole, you wouldn't have wanted to go to sea with men that you couldn't trust in an emergency. And I rather suspect that men like Cabrillo would have chosen from whatever grouping he had the best he could get. Men he knew, men who had been tested, and those he could trust.
Dr. James Moriarty. Claire, what was it that Cabrillo and his men were searching for? Why did they come here? I suppose not to find San Diego Harbor.
The motivations for exploration of New Spain in general were three things: glory, God, and gold. Glory for themselves, certainly they hoped to find that. God, they hoped to bring their version of Christianity to the pagans, to bring this to the savages, and gold, of course. Specifically, what Cabrillo and his men were instructed to search for was the Strait of Anian, what the English called the Northwest Passage, this great mythical river that, of course, nobody ever did find, that was supposed to flow between the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans and would make it much easier to get through this empty continent of North America.
As far as looking for gold and great cities is concerned,
Dr. Moriarty points out that there was really no reason not to expect another highly advanced and rich Indian civilization on the expeditions to the north.
All the great discoveries in Mexico City had been made. Marvelous places had been found in Maya land and Yucatan Peninsula, representing the Maya culture. And then suddenly, after some expeditions to the south, you have the discovery of the Inca peoples. There wasn't any doubt in anyone's mind, nor would it have been logical to assume that these were the only great civilizations producing the kind of treasure in rare metals and precious gems, etc. It was logical to assume that all of that distance that they knew must lie to the north and the northwest along this coast. Surely there had to be other cities. And, of course, they had their legends of the seven cities of Cibola, and they had some of the fibs that were told by Cabeza de Vaca, which added to it. Even if he was a liar and everyone knew it, he might have been a liar who passed through El Dorado, who knows? And the dream of great riches and wealth and new discovery. And that's, of course, something that, I love Samuel Eliot Morison because somewhere he said, why do we always deny them the nobility, referring to the great explorers, that we would automatically give almost anyone else, and that is that they were not just after wealth and riches, which were the obvious and upfront things, but that there were men looking for what was on the other side of the hill. There were men who wanted to experience the new and the bizarre, and who were willing to risk a good deal for that pleasure alone. Thank God we still have people like that, and we know they exist.
Dr. James Moriarty, University of San Diego. Claire, at the beginning of the program, we talked about the lack of information available on Cabrillo, and it seems that a very basic fact indeed is still missing from the picture. Now, most people assume that Cabrillo was Portuguese, and I'd like to ask you if you think most historians are quite sure about that, the fact that Cabrillo was indeed Portuguese?
Well, up until certainly very recently, and in many of the books that are still being reprinted, the story of the discovery of California is briefly told, and in almost all of the histories that I'm familiar with, it is simply said sort of parenthetically that Cabrillo was a Portuguese navigator. And until the article published by Dr. Michael Mathis in the Journal of San Diego History, I think this was simply unquestioningly assumed. It wasn't something about which people thought there was really any controversy.
Dr. Michael Mathis is a professor of history currently at the University of San Francisco. And recently, when he visited San Diego, he explained his argument that Cabrillo was not Portuguese.
Well, first I'll refer to him as Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo, because since I do believe that he is Spanish, Rodriguez would be his proper last name, his family name, rather than Cabrillo, although he's popularly called Cabrillo. My basic argument is that, one, there is no definite proof to his having been Portuguese. That is, there are no baptismal certificates, birth records, or anything of this sort, which indicate that he was Portuguese. And the second is that he reached a level in the Spanish bureaucracy and hierarchy within the New World of such a nature that it would be highly indicative of the fact that he was not a foreigner, but was rather a Castilian, in fact, not even just a Spaniard, but rather a Castilian. The contemporary documentation at the time tended to always refer to a person who was a non-Castilian by their particular nationality or regionality. And in the case of Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo, there is no such mention.
At this point, I guess we had better discuss why then it is almost universally thought that Cabrillo, or Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo, was Portuguese.
The basic argument is simply based upon a statement by Antonio de Herrera, In his work published in 1615 on a general history of the Spanish expansion in the New World, in which he casually refers and very passively refers to Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo as being Portuguese. Just simply the statement, a Portuguese navigator. And from that point on, the entire argument for nationality has been based.
Would it not have been true that Herrera would have had available to him any of the documents that we may not have now? For example, he may have had a birth certificate, or he may have had some other document that does not exist anymore. Why would we suppose that he's not correct on that point?
There's perfectly good reason to believe that Herrera could have had such material available to him that no longer exists or is no longer accessible. However, two points. One, that additional documentation, which is still available relative to Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo, as I say, makes no mention of him having been Portuguese at all. And yet this is rather extensive documentation. Letters from the Viceroy Antonio de Mendoza discussing his voyage to California. Various claims by his grandchildren relative to his properties in Guatemala. Other ephemeral documentation in which there is no mention made at all of his having been Portuguese. Further, Herrera was a man who sat down to write a general history, which in its largest, most annotated edition, which was published by the Spanish Royal Academy of History, was a 17-volume work, an encyclopedic study of Spanish overseas expansion. Similarly to this case, there are various errors in Herrera's work. Anybody that sits down to write an encyclopedic history is invariably going to make a mistake or two somewhere along the line, and it's just as possible that he could have made a mistake in this case.
Dr. Moriarty, on the other hand, is of the opinion that Cabrillo was Portuguese. He sees no particular reason not to believe the word of Herrera.
The question is yet unsolved. Let me go on record as saying that. No mention of Cabrillo nationality is made, excepting in the document you referred to that Michael Mathis mentioned, which is done about 100 years after his death. But that is a statement. It says he was Portuguese. The man using those documents had the availability of every document relating to this period in the Royal Archives. He was not a man easily fooled. He was an excellent scholar, and Michael mentions the same thing in his paper. Now, there is no answer to Michael's final contention that there is no historic document of contemporary, in a contemporary sense, relating to the nationality of Cabrillo. But there is a growing, and has been growing for a long time, weight of evidence to indicate that that statement that he was Portuguese is true. First of all, it is well known and accepted by all historians that I know that there was a law that no one outside of a person who was of Spanish birth could even enter the New World, let alone be on any expeditions of discovery. And these expeditions of discovery is the principal thing. They were not allowed on the expeditions of discovery. Certainly a number of people got into the New World, all right, and were ignored for whatever reasons. But on the expeditions themselves, the law was very clear. Expeditions of discovery were secret. And naturally, the Royal Spanish government didn't want this new knowledge to leak out, and for a long time they kept as much information, maps and what have you, as secret as possible. Well, anyway, there isn't any question that men of quality with talents that were needed, these ideas are going to be overcome. And Cabrillo was unique. He goes back to the conquest itself. He is the man who helped develop and build the boats for Cortes, which on the Great Lake were partially, probably in a large part, responsible for the conquest of Mexico City or Tenochtitlan. He served very well in Honduras and other places, so he demonstrated not only soldierly but nautical qualities. He obviously could navigate and do a variety of very specialized things that very few of the early conquistadors could do. Those people with specific talents in any trial situation will generally be brought to the fore regardless, it seems to me, certainly by pragmatic people like Cortez, and later on by Alvarado and Mendoza, too. In addition, the cultural variation, and all the Portuguese will be angry at me for this, I suppose, but the cultural variation is relatively minor between the Spanish and the Portuguese, and certainly at that period, they weren't all that different. So one could adjust in one culture or the other without the cross-cultural problems that others would have. So here you have a man who meets all the requirements and is specifically trained to certain tasks. Naturally, they'd use him, it seems logical.
But Dr. Mathis finds the Spanish law regarding non-Spanish participants in the expeditions lends evidence to his side of the argument that Cabrillo may have been Spanish.
It was legal to work for the Spanish crown if you declared your nationality and swore allegiance to the Spanish monarchy. We have cases such as Columbus and Magellan, who are very evident cases of great explorers, who, though of non-Castilian birth, nonetheless worked for the Spanish monarchy in a very technical capacity. So it was not illegal for him to work for the Spanish crown. It would have been terribly illegal if he'd have been caught hiding this out. But I find it very difficult to believe that a man could achieve the level of importance. He was a confidant of the viceroy, of the confidant of the conqueror of Guatemala, Pedro de Alvarado. He circulated among conquistadores. I find it very difficult to believe that he could have achieved that rank and been successful in hiding his nationality that long. Well, virtually his entire life. And I think a point that could be well taken here is that at least I haven't gone through all the national census rolls, but I've gone through all the telephone directories of Portugal and all of those of Spain. And there are no Cabrillos or any last names even similar to Cabrillo, which could be considered to be an adaptation of the name that own a telephone in Portugal. Whereas there are seven families of this name in the telephone directory in Madrid alone, which seems to be indicative of something here.
Dr. Moriarty has a different interpretation of the name Cabrillo.
I am of the opinion that it is a nickname, and it's a soldierly nickname, too, and maybe a little salacious, but it refers to a small goat, and soldiers have a tendency to give those kind of names to officers they like. They're very seldom given to officers they don't like. His men probably called him Little Goat, the Little Goat, and that's an indication, too. By the way, the name is therefore Spanish, not Portuguese, as the soldiers he was dealing with were all Spanish, or at least most of them were.
Dr. James Moriarty, and before him we heard Dr. Michael Mathis, professor of history at the University of San Francisco. Of course, both men's arguments are much more detailed than the short version we've presented here. We included the argument for a number of reasons. In the course of the presentation of the two sides, we learned quite a bit of information about Cabrillo himself. And I think we've seen a very good example of how we can have two very different interpretations of similar material. If Cabrillo could have known the problems he would cause future scholars, he could have done a thing so simple as writing his name differently.
He signed his name Juan Rod. It was kind of a rubric. That leaves you without knowing whether he would have written Rodriguez the Portuguese way or Rodriguez the Spanish way. If we ever find a thing with him, his name written out fully, we'll have one more clue. A number of problems have been solved. We know that he had more than two ships. We know that he had Portuguese on board in positions of authority. We are learning slowly but surely more and more about him. And it seems so strange because the search for Cabrillo began back in the 1830s. by people like Buckingham Smith and a variety of other scholars who had to do with the first translations of the summary log. The possibility that the log itself will be discovered someday. Can you imagine what a thrill that'll be? That will give us information. We will have his own words, for one thing, and not a transliteration of what the log said, not a summary. His own words. One statement like, the land looks like my home. Near Lisbon.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Would be just great. Yeah. Or the reverse, near Madrid. One way or another, a statement like that, you see, could solve things. And people say things like this when they're keeping logs and what have you. You always compare in descriptions, you say. Oh, the finding of that log would be a wonderful thing. And does the log exist? Why, the chances of it existing are very good. No one can say with any truth whatsoever that they have investigated the archives of Spain, which are pretty scattered anyway, but still enormous bundles of documents that haven't been opened in 200 and 300 years. What about the document that's misfiled in such a vast collection? Only by sheerest luck, be needle in the haystack. But it has happened in the past. It'll happen again. I have real hopes, and I know I can't really discuss it in any way other than that I have real hopes that the log does exist.
Dr. James Moriarty of the University of San Diego. I'm curious what the fate of Cabrillo was after he left San Diego Harbor. We took him that far in the reading from the log. He called it San Miguel and then headed north to continue his expedition. What then?
Well, the voyage continued on up the coast of California, and they stopped at a number of places, for example, in Santa Barbara and on the Channel Islands, of which there are several. On one of these islands, in November, Cabrillo fell. And he broke either an arm or a leg. The accounts differ. The voyage continued, but evidently there was an infection or something of that nature as a result of this fall. And on January 3rd, 1543, Cabrillo died and was buried on one of the Channel Islands also. He turned over command of the voyage to his pilot, Bartolome Ferrer, or Ferrello, as it's sometimes written, and the ships were ultimately brought back to Mexico. But Cabrillo was buried there on one of these Channel Islands. And a few years ago, Dr. Robert Heiser of the University of California, in looking through some stones that had come from the Channel Islands, came across one with markings on it that looked like J, R, and a little subscript S. And Dr. Heiser has every reason to believe that this may have been a grave marker for Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo, and there is a replica of it at the Cabrillo Monument now that people can see.
Finally, when Cabrillo died, was he praised as a hero? Was he considered a great man for having discovered these vast new lands that we now call California?
Well, he may have thought of himself as a failure. Certainly, he had been sent to search for the Strait of Anian and to search for these rich cities, gold and silver and so on. He probably considered himself a failure because he had not found these things. And certainly, the government of New Spain did not regard the discoveries of Cabrillo in Alta California as being worthwhile following up. Nothing was done about colonizing that area, following up on his claim to the area for a couple of hundred years.
And what would you say his importance is to San Diego? Aside from the obvious, he was the first European to come here. What else?
Well, it seems to me that Cabrillo's real importance for San Diego lies in the fact that our written history begins with Cabrillo. Certainly he's important also as the discoverer in the European sense, the first European to discover and to record that he discovered Alta California. He's the first person to have applied the name California to this entire area, or at least, if not the first person to have used the name, to have popularized it, to have affixed it firmly to this area. And he's important for these reasons.
Dr. Claire Crane, San Diego historian and chief consultant for the series of programs on San Diego history. It was many years before Spain acted on Cabrillo's claim to the port of San Miguel. In 1602, Vizcaíno made a voyage up the coast, and it is from him that we gain the name of San Diego. And it was 227 years after Cabrillo's discovery before Spanish colonization began in earnest with the arrival of Father Junipero Serra, a determined Franciscan padre who was instrumental to the success of the San Diego settlement. Father Serra will be the topic of next week's program. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego. The programs are heard each week at 12:30 Tuesday afternoon with a repeat broadcast Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. A resource packet is available with these programs. Send $2 to KPBS-FM, San Diego 92182, and ask for the San Diego History Resource Packet. We also welcome your comments on this series. The address again is KPBS-FM, San Diego 92182. I'm Peter Hamlin, series producer, thanking you for joining us. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a production of public radio station KPBS-FM and is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.